Hi everyone, it's Bo. While I was walking outside this morning getting my light viewing practice in, I was struck by a wild idea about depression that I wanted to share with you. And it's synthesized from emerging concepts in science, and in particular in the relationship between depression and inflammation, and also depression and the mind and brain. This idea made immediate sense to me, and I thought it might be helpful and even comforting and exciting to any of you who go through depression or have loved ones who do. So for this to make sense, I need to give you a really quick background on the part of the brain that contributes to depression, on how we mitigate that function of the brain using a certain form of body awareness that I talk about a lot called interoception, and then also a little bit about what we know about depression and interoception, and finally the relationship between inflammation and depression and how they all relate in this kind of mosaic of functioning and connectivity. So there's a way in which depression might actually lead us to misinterpret the signals of inflammation in the body in a way that makes sense, but can also be harmful to us. And I'd like to talk about what that means for those of us who experience depression, either in kind of cyclic bouts or in a chronic and sustained way, and how both interoception and reducing inflammation, but also understanding the relationship between them can help. And this synthesizes many of the ideas we covered in Saturday's workshop in a way that I hope is really helpful and, again, sort of inspiring, exciting to all of you. So in the neuroscience of depression, there has been this sort of emerging field that looks at a part of our prefrontal cortex, which has evolved a lot throughout our evolutionary development, called the default mode network. And when our brain is at rest, and that means not really focused on a task, it tends to default to a certain state. And that state includes mental time travel, so that our thoughts are not in the present, but they return to the past, and they kind of ruminate, which is sort of to chew on. I think of a cow sometimes chewing on the same sort of cud or grass over and over again. And so ruminating on the past and obsessing about what we should have said or done differently, or what someone else had said and done, and the particular tone in which they may have said it. And then we can also mental time travel to the future and worry about what's about to happen and hasn't happened yet. Again, not really being in the present. And the default mode network also is characterized by something that's very much a feature of depression, which includes negative self-reference, the sort of tendency to interpret all activities and people and interactions as having some negative, problematic meaning about ourself and self-worth and the inherent sort of value of ourselves in the world. Our default mode network constructs narratives about experience, particularly experiences we might be having in the body, like a sensation of pain or difficulty becomes our body being broken or wrong, or an incipient sign of some medical syndrome. And it also could tell stories about interactions that we have with others. And then on top of all that, our default mode function attaches meaning to experiences. This bad thing is happening, therefore that means the world is an unsafe place, or I am an unlovable person, or I'll never receive what I deserve in life. Part of the problem in depression is that, and also other issues too, I want to specify, is that the default mode often gets stimulated in response to direct experience that we have in our bodies. And part of the therapeutic value of mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, is that it encourages us to view sensations and emotions as passing states of awareness and experience. Just to be clear, the default mode network is an inflammatory response, and it tends to go along with inflammation in our immune system, in our pain pathways, in our autonomic nervous system. It kind of mounts an inflammatory response to these thoughts and this brain activity. Just to be clear, it's a function not just of the brain, but of what the brain does when our mind is doing this also. Research in neuroscience has indicated that the default mode network activity, when our brain is meant to be resting or when we're not focused on a task, but also in depression, sometimes even when we are focused on a task, it's unable to pay attention and kind of keeps returning to these difficult, problematic functions. And again, just to finish that sentence, the default mode network is the cause of unhappiness, not a result of being depressed or unhappy. And that means being able to reduce it is of therapeutic value and sometimes is an indicator of getting better. Once again, just to reiterate the kind of key function of default mode that has been found, really studied extensively in depression and chronic pain and found to be significant, is the negative self-reference, judging ourselves in a negative way in response to things that happen or even in response to our own internal experience. I'm such a loser. My body is broken. I'm unlovable. And it turns out that engaging in these functions makes people more likely to re-experience depression within a certain amount of time from when we're doing it. And at times, there have been links between serotonin receptors and default mode functioning and depression. Sometimes antidepressants, when they are effective, can reduce the kind of intensity with which default mode activity is happening in the brain. And then also, I wanted to be sure to say that default mode functioning is not all bad. It's actually linked to creative thinking, a kind of helpful creative mind wandering, when it's not hijacked in this negative way. Now I'd like to segue from default mode to one of the antidotes to that. And I mentioned mindfulness-based stress reduction having been found to reduce default mode. Often focusing on a task like art or music or studying something can be helpful. In depression in particular, sometimes focusing on a task has been found to be not enough. But returning to this ability to focus on the body and particularly interoception, which is part of mindfulness-based stress reduction. So you can think of interoception as mindfulness of the body and just the ability to receive information that's coming from in our own bodies, sensations, and also emotions. Technically, it refers to our ability to receive, to appraise or interpret, to respond to, and then to regulate signals that are coming from our body. And we have receptors in cells and tissues and organs that are continually collecting information about the internal state of the body. We have, for example, circulatory receptors that monitor heartbeat. We have respiratory interoceptors that track the pace and depth of our breath. One reason why I like to focus on sensations of breathing, not just simply the fact that we are breathing, is because it stimulates interoception. And then we have gastrointestinal ones that oversee hunger or fullness or a little bit of swelling or distension in our abdomen. I sometimes jokingly refer to that as enteroception, but it includes a host of different functions: temperature, pain, itch or tickle, vasomotor flushing like hot flashes, muscular sensations like tension and soreness, and isometric exercise, things related to bones like bone bruising or fracture or joint ache, nausea or cramps or illness. We're going to come back to that. That I want to flag as significant. Headache and migraine. Fatigue, including chronic fatigue. And again, that's significant. We'll come back to that. Sensual touch, emotional touch, like soft touch, like when we groom one another. Sexual touch and orgasm. And again, this becomes significant, so I'm flagging it in advance. Acute or systemic inflammation and levels of inflammatory cytokines or metabolites in the body. There is a really strong connection between interoception and our capacity to sense what's happening in our immune system. And then there is a really intimate connection between depression and interoception. In fact, in depression, there tends to be a deficit in interoception, where we are unable to really receive signals that are coming from the body, and sometimes we don't interpret them well. As I mentioned before, they become signs of pathology rather than ways that our body is talking with us. And I mentioned this during the weekend, but there are scales that measure different indices of interoception, like emotions and emotional regulation, that's part of interoception. Attention regulation, that's really significant. Noticing what's happening in the body, as I mentioned. Listening to the body. And then one in particular called body trust. And it turns out that people with moderate to severe depression often score very low on the body trust and body listening, noticing, emotional awareness, and emotional regulation scales on these measures of interoception. It turns out that a lot of studies also show that when people with depression do sense signals that are coming from the body, in other words, when they are quote-unquote interocepting, they tend to be less accurate about what they're perceiving in their bodies. They might not kind of get a strong enough signal. And I've talked about before this notion of depression as a disease of disembodiment. In other words, low or difficult interoception, and also proprioception. And more recently, I've talked with you all about low levels of body agency, which is another form of embodied intelligence. So that being low in depression also. And so now I want to move to kind of the third node that we're talking about, which is depression and inflammation. Multiple studies show a connection between high levels of inflammation or inflammatory markers in the body and depression. For example, people with low-grade inflammation are at increased risk for depression. And here, this gets us into kind of the cool theory. But before I talk about that, I wanted to share a study that talked about And this was in the Nature Journal, really well-respected journal. And they looked at the depression and inflammation. This was from the Netherlands study of depression and anxiety, which was a 9-year study, which is really pretty cool. And they looked at the relationship between an inflammatory marker called lipopolysaccharides, or LPS, and depression symptoms. They looked at this in both women and men with an average age of 42 years, and more than half of them had a current mood disorder, and then some did not. And they found that lipopolysaccharides had, when they were elevated, a really strong association with symptoms of depression and also arousal of the autonomic nervous system, particularly in the fight, flight, or sympathetic direction. And they found that inflammation was related to the course of depression and also the presence of specific symptoms of depression. Just a little aside that these lipopolysaccharides also happen to be found in high levels in people with leaky gut syndrome, which is an increased permeability in the small intestine, in the gut, and that's a kind of microbiome issue. So that's kind of cool and exciting. And then just a little bit more information about that, and then I'll circle back to why that's important. So let me find that. So many studies, in fact, studies that are considered meta-analyses, so they're looking at multiple studies, have found that people with major depression exhibit an increased inflammatory response. And that means that they have all these inflammation-causing molecules, sometimes called pro-inflammatory cytokines in the body. And that those are detected not only in the blood, but in the cerebrospinal fluid of people with depression. Some of those are the interleukins 6 and 8 in particular, something called TNF or tumor necrosis factor, C-reactive protein or CRP. And it turns out that in people who take their own lives that have depression, there's an increased expression of acute inflammation and also the activation of what are normally kind of passive or quiet inflammatory genes just prior to taking their lives. Genes that are linked with depression are also linked with this inflammatory response. And it turns out that blocking these inflammatory molecules has been shown to improve depression. And in addition, some kind of cool studies have looked at how lowering levels of inflammation can even help antidepressants work better. And what's significant about that is that antidepressants often do not work, in fact, in 66% of all people who take them. But even in people in whom they do work, they can stop working, which is called the poop out effect. So blocking inflammatory molecules can help with that, which is really significant. We'll take a breath here together. I'm a little excited today. And now to kind of go into this final series of thoughts. In evolutionary theory, depression is often seen as being accompanied by what are called sickness behaviors, avoiding social interaction, a lack of pleasure in everyday activities, kind of a kind of internalization of things, maybe becoming still and moving less. I talked about how gross body movements, overall movement, and even slowness of movement are part of depression. That's sometimes referred to as psychomotor slowing. And it turns out that a lot of these symptoms of depression that are viewed in the mental health professions as pathological, and I'm putting that in air quotes, are known as sickness behaviors that are adaptive from an evolutionary perspective because they are responses to inflammation. And social avoidance also helps everyone else around us not catch whatever inflammatory thing we are fighting off. But that kind of social withdrawal and physiological stillness allows energy for fighting infection and for healing wounds. There's a similar theory in anxiety that hypervigilance can kind of create protection from these pathogens. And in all these studies that are showing a connection between inflammatory markers and depression, the idea is that people that have low-grade inflammation and depression are kind of, just to make this really clear, their symptoms like not eating as much or loss of libido or this physical slowing or irritability or malaise or social withdrawal is a sickness behavior that allows for inflammation to be reduced. And so a lot of these symptoms that are seen as negative or unintelligent or problematic or pathological have likely evolved over time as protective, as allowing for the quietness and stillness that let our immune system recover, and that also are protective to others around us. And so the exciting thought that I had today in bringing all this together while I was walking is that because we, as just a general sort of global entity, that people in general are maybe less encouraged to do interoception, more encouraged to focus on what's happening around us. But in particular, people with depression tend to do less interoception. We are perhaps slower to pick up on these sickness behaviors when they begin to happen, and we're slower to detect levels of inflammation in our bodies as they rise. And so while other people might be perceiving sickness behaviors and inflammation levels as signs to care for the body by withdrawing, by resting, which is one of my great passions, even forms of dynamic rest, that depression can progress to an even greater level before it's noticed and after the period at which interventions to lower inflammation can be most helpful, in that critical period before depression becomes super moderate to severe. But the other thought that goes along with that is that people with depression, because of this default mode network activity, because of the tendency to interpret what's happening in the body as negative indicators or negative signs about the self, is that when depression is occurring, and that means when inflammation is occurring, there might be a tendency for people with depression to misinterpret their own inflammation and their own sickness behaviors in response, like slowing of movement, resting, withdrawal, as negative reflections of the self. I'm a loser because I'm feeling tired and I want to rest. My body is broken because I'm just not feeling well, or my gut is inflamed. Or I'm not lovable because I'm perceiving rejection socially, or my own desire to withdraw a little bit as being pathological. That in fact, we're not picking up on, just to kind of review, early signs of depression and inflammation and sickness behaviors that actually make a lot of sense and that are adaptive and intelligent. We're not picking up on those as early that allow us to intervene. We're not picking up on inflammatory levels rising early enough and being able to intervene. And then when we do pick up on those later on in the cycle and they're more severe, they then become interpreted as signs of our own inadequacy or lack of humanity or unlovability, which is like a triple whammy. So I hope that makes sense. And I hope it kind of underlines the notion of interoception, and in particular, the ability to detect inflammation as being really an antidote to depression and training ourselves to do that earlier. And also when we have those difficult thoughts and interpretations of our own sickness behaviors and our own intelligent responses to inflammation, that we can begin to notice those as they're happening and to appreciate them, these sickness behaviors and responses to inflammation, for the intelligence that they do in fact represent. I hope this is helpful to you, and I hope my excitement is contagious, and I hope this also is another kind of indicator that attention to the body can actually be incredibly helpful in detecting depression and inflammation earlier, addressing them at an earlier point in the cycle, and then also in reducing depression when it does arise. That's it for now. Ciao.